Good afternoon, gentlemen. We appreciate you moving your argument time to 2 o'clock. We had a lengthy argument with cross appeals that we heard before you. So if you have talked to the clerk and announced the time that you would like to take for your argument, we're ready to proceed, we'll call the first case. Are you all ready?
Appeal's ready, Your Honor.
The court will now call Antonio Perez Nelson, a.k.a. Antonio Perez Nelson, versus the state of Texas. May I please the court? Mr. Adam Arrington will argue for the appellant. Mr. Steve Conder will argue for the state.
Mr. Arrington?
Thank you, Madam Justice, and may it please the court. Long time no see. So our client, Antonio Perez Nelson, was charged with and convicted of 3 counts of aggravated sexual assault of a child and received 3 life sentences under the penal code. Because of the specific nature of this offense, he was not eligible for parole. And I'll briefly get into the facts. I'd like to reserve a more detailed discussion of the facts for when I get into the 6th and 7th points of error, which concern the DNA issues on appeal. But basically, the indictment in this case alleged 3 separate acts of sexual assault on the child complainant. One alleged penile vaginal contact. The other 2 alleged digital penetration of the anus and vagina. And we believe that our legal sufficiency points of error, we challenge the sufficiency of the evidence to support his convictions on counts 2 and 3 of the indictment. We think those are adequately briefed, except I just wanted to bring up one thing on point of error 2, which challenges the sufficiency of the evidence to support his conviction on count 3, which alleged penetration of the anus. There's a case I didn't cite in our brief because it's an unpublished opinion, so not binding precedent, but because the state referenced this court's opinion in Mallett v. State in its brief, I wanted to call this court's attention to Alberts v. State. That's an unpublished opinion out of the Texarkana Court of Appeals. The cite on that is 2009 Tex App Lexus 9430. Would Your Honors like the Westlaw citation as well?
Yes, please.
2009 Westlaw 4724302. That's 4724302. And if you'll look at footnote 4 of that opinion and the surrounding discussion, then I think you'll find that to be helpful in analyzing this issue. What this really turns on is the difference between anus and buttocks. It's well established in Texas case law that when penetration of the anus is alleged, or contact with, in this case it was penetration that was alleged, it's not enough to simply prove contact with or even penetration of the buttocks, because anus and buttocks are different. On to issues 3 and 4, which concern the excusal of the juror who informed everyone on the second day of trial that his wife had filed for divorce, and he had basically arrived home and found that half of his stuff was gone. We think this issue is pretty well adequately addressed in our brief. I wanted to emphasize, we find, just to make absolutely clear, the abuse of discretion lies in the trial court effectively feeding the juror what to say through leading questions. And this is why we quoted verbatim in our brief.
Counsel, I did want to ask you about that because, of course, there are plenty of cases where people are excused because they're distraught for one reason or another. Do you have any case where a trial court led a juror and because of the nature of the questioning and the excusing of the juror, that in itself was held to be error?
I could not find one saying either way, Your Honor. No. So, yes, that does not appear to be an issue that's been decided by any Texas court. But we think the court started off doing the right thing by asking open-ended, non-leading questions. But the juror didn't really respond in a way that would give the trial court the kind of answers it would need to find him disabled from sitting, and then segued into basically questions that if an attorney had asked a witness on the stand would be objectionable as leading. And on to one thing on issue five. This was where we argued that the trial court should have declared a mistrial after a witness violated the motion in limine by telling everyone, testifying in the jury's presence, that she introduced appellant to her daughter after he got out of prison. And I noticed that in its argument as to why this is not reversible error, it is true that the trial court did give an instruction to disregard. The state referenced Nunley v. State for the proposition that because the witness's answer, and the witness was the child complainant's mother, who was appellant's girlfriend, because the witness's answer was actually responsive to the question posed by defense counsel, it was more likely cured by the trial court's instruction to disregard. The state cites Nunley v. State for that proposition. I checked Nunley, and in that case, we think Nunley is distinguishable because this was it is in the record that this witness was instructed not to mention prison. So we think the violation, the knowing violation of a prior instruction makes this all the more egregious, and it shouldn't, that should count for more than if the answer was technically responsive to the question asked by defense counsel. I think it's any reasonable view of the record would be that the defense was not trying to elicit an answer that his client had been in prison. Now, on to issues 6 and 7, which was the main reason why we requested oral argument in this case. The there were a total of 8 DNA samples collected and sent to the DPS lab in Garland for testing in this case. These included known DNA samples from the child complainant and the appellant, Mr. Nelson, as well as other swabs from around her body, including her anus, her panties, and other areas. And as best I can, I would not call myself an expert on DNA serology, but I've gotten more familiar with the process over the course of researching these issues. Basically, as explained by the testifying analyst at trial, Claire Myers, there's a four-step process that these samples are put through when they're sent to the lab. The extraction set and then measuring, where she said they measure how much DNA is present in each sample. And the third is amplification, where they make millions of copies of specific regions in the DNA strand. And then the fourth step, she didn't really label it. I've just been calling it separation because she said they put it onto an instrument called a genetic analyzer that will separate the DNA by its size and charge and communicate with the software program to then generate the DNA profiles. And in this case, all those steps, the entire testing process was performed by an analyst named Chow Nguyen. And our argument on this is, well, twofold. It's really threefold. But regarding the testimony of Claire Myers, the testifying analyst who looked at the DNA profiles and came to testify as to her opinions, that was based on work done by Chow Nguyen. And we're saying that that was a violation of his our client's confrontation clause rights.
Counsel, wasn't there also testimony that she basically double checked that work?
She did say she reviewed everything and checked that it was done correctly. But that's exactly what the analyst in Birch v. State, the testifying analyst in Birch v. State, said that she did, and the Court of Criminal Appeals held that was not enough because she lacked personal knowledge of the testing procedures. She could testify that it was done correctly, but she didn't actually perform the tests herself, so it was not an adequate substitute. And in fact, the Court of Criminal Appeals has even gone as far as to say that even if it would be redundant to question the other analyst who performed the testing, that the Confrontation Clause does not tolerate dispensing with confrontation simply because the court believes that questioning one witness about another's testimonial statements provides a fair enough opportunity for cross-examination. And the other prong of this argument was the objection made at trial was that in addition to that, because she's testifying based on the work done by someone else and they don't have the benefit of cross-examining that witness, that it's more prejudicial than probative. Also, that covers both points of error 6 and 7. A separate objection was made and a lengthy motion hearing was held challenging the reliability of the methodology and the results of the DNA testing. Basically, I should have prefaced with this, but the expressly Claire Myers, the testifying analyst, testified that she was there to offer her expert opinion about the DNA analysis and interpretation in their laboratory case. As I've already mentioned, the role of Chow Nguyen was to, she performed the DNA testing, but it wasn't just limited to that. It went beyond the four-step process I laid out, and Claire Myers even testified that Chow Nguyen made interpretations on it, and she did the laboratory analysis. She actually did analysis. So this is where we get to confrontation. Now, the state relied at trial, and apparently does in its brief on appeal, on the case of Paredes v. State, a court of criminal appeals case from a couple of years ago. And really, this issue, the confrontation issue 7 in our brief, turns on whether or not the data, the analysis, the underlying work done by Chow Nguyen on which Claire Myers' opinions and testimony was based is testimonial. Because the Court of Criminal Appeals in Paredes said that in that case, this raw computer-generated data on which the testifying analyst testimony was based is not testimonial. We think this case is easily distinguishable from Paredes because, again, according to Claire Myers' own testimony at the motion hearing, this was not just raw computer-generated data she was looking at. There was a human hand and mind involved here. Claire Myers this wasn't just a matter of making calculations and putting stuff on an instrument for measurement to generate DNA profiles. She actually made interpretations and did lab analysis. So we think that certainly, as far as whether or not the definition of testimonial from Crawford, Melendez-Diaz in those cases, whether or not these were statements made under circumstances that would reasonably expect someone to believe they would be available for use in a later criminal proceeding, I think it's important to mention the indictment in this case was filed on March 17, 2015. The evidence at the motion hearing established that these samples were submitted for testing at the lab on March 18, 2015. So in other words, by the time these samples went to the lab, our client had been indicted. At the time that all of this testing and analysis was going on, they knew, or at least should have been aware, that there was a criminal proceeding that had been initiated. He hadn't just been arrested. They had filed the charges. So I think any reasonable person would look at this when they're doing DNA testing from samples that have been collected as part of a criminal investigation and say, you know, it's reasonable to expect these would be used prosecutorially at some point in the future. I think, if I could just have one moment here. So, as far as the 403 argument related to the more prejudicial, the prejudicial effect of the evidence outweighing its probative value, the Court of Criminal Appeals has acknowledged the powerful effect that scientific evidence can have on a jury, and I thought it was very poignant that the trial court in this case even acknowledged the DNA testimony and evidence spread through Claire Myers and the actual physical exhibits of the trial was, quote, stuff that juries never understand but nod their heads like they do, unquote. And as I'm almost out of time, I want to briefly mention one thing regarding Issue 8, which is our cruel and unusual argument. The state alleges that we didn't preserve this issue because there was no objection made at sentencing. It's well established, and we cited to this court's opinion in Pantoja from last year, rendered not 1 year ago, that an argument that a sentence is cruel and unusual can be raised for the first time in a motion for new trial, and as long as...
I was going to ask you about that. Do you have any further obligation to get a hearing on the motion for new trial, or is simply filing it enough to preserve the error?
As I read the case law from Pantoja and the litany of cases cited therein, just merely raising it in a timely filed motion for new trial preserves that argument for appellate review. So there's nothing else, then I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington.
May it please the court. Stephen Condor on behalf of the City of Texas. Unless the court has questions, I'm going to focus upon the confrontation and the DNA admissibility issues that were raised by defense counsel's argument. The first one is the confrontation clause issue. I'm going to take that one first. I believe it's the state's position that the Paredes case issued by the Court of Criminal Appeals in 2015 is square on point with what occurred in this case. Is it in Paredes the court reconciled the confrontation issues with the reality of how DNA processing is done so, and that is a series of different people doing different aspects, but then trying to figure out what is the actual crucial analysis that is the subject of the real confrontation at trial. And they did say, you know, confrontation doesn't allow us to just put any lab analyst up there and to testify to a report they had nothing to deal with. And I think that's fair, and I would agree with that. And testimony by an expert explaining what some other lab non-testifying analyst did does not provide an adequate substitute. I think we can all agree with that, too. But this is usually about more than just mere surrogacy. They said for an expert's testimony based upon forensic analysts performed solely by a non-testifying analyst to be admissible. The testifying expert must testify about his own opinions and conclusions. While the testifying expert can rely upon information from a non-testifying analyst, the testifying expert cannot act merely as a surrogate to introduce that testimony. They went on to say the crucial analysis in these DNA cases is determining the DNA match and testifying as their own conclusions on it. Now let's look at what the two analysts did in this case. Chow Nguyen, she did extraction, quantification, and amplification. She inputted the data into the electrophoresis instrument, I'm going to struggle over this word, in order to obtain electropherograms or DNA profiles, and she examined them and made some initial calculations. At that point, Claire Myers went back and looked at this, and she reviewed the initial statistical report. She verified that the items that were inputted into the instrumentation were valid, and then she took the raw data that came out of it, the lines on the paper, which, according to the Court of Criminal Appeals, when they say, without the analysis, are really don't tell you anything at all if you don't have an analyst to tell you what they mean. And she made the comparisons where the locations allowed them, and she calculated the statistics and issued her own report. All of that was before the defendant to be cross-examined on, and all that's why her report meets the confrontation clause analysis, because everything she presented was her own conclusions, her own results from reviewing all of the evidence. As for the admissibility of the DNA evidence itself, I think that, again, I think unless the court has specific questions, I think we fairly well briefed this issue by both sides on this. I think it's clear that Ms. Myers explained her background, and she had a lot of experience testifying in DNA cases. She explained why the concerns that have been in the past about mixture protocols did not come into play because they had already resolved them before she did the testing on this. And I think she fully explained why the testing results that she presented were valid and were reliable. So unless the court has questions, the state would pray for an affirmance in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Condor.
Thank you.
Mr. Arrington, rebuttal?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Since he basically limited his oral argument to the DNA issues, I'll just address that. We think it is a critical fact, and this goes to issue six, not the confrontation issue, but the admissibility, the 702 objection made to the DNA testimony, that although Claire Myers did testify that these issues had been discovered and resolved prior to the testing that was done and the report being issued in this case, it was established prior to the court's ruling on the suppression motion that there were new protocols implemented in March of 2016. That was long after all of the testing was done, and the record does not indicate precisely when the testing was done in this case. All we can say for sure is that based on the evidence in the record, it was done sometime between March 18, 2015, when the samples were submitted to the lab, and October 30th of 2015, which is the date Claire Myers issued her report.
Counsel, I'm assuming that your client had every opportunity to go into these sorts of things on cross-examination?
Well,
the changing of the protocols and all that sort of thing?
Yes, he did. But that, I mean, at that point, the evidence had already presented before the jury. We're arguing basically that the trial court abused its discretion in admitting the evidence because that goes to the gatekeeper function of the trial court. But yes, that he did. And regarding just really briefly to finish up on that, she acknowledged that she did not go back and supplement her report or revise her calculations and interpretations after those new protocols were implemented in March of 2016. And I won't waste the court's time repeating myself. Suffice to say, we don't believe Paredes is on point because we're not talking about just raw data or lines on paper in this case. And in fact, in looking at there's been a number of cases just in the past couple of years since Paredes was decided that appeared to follow that holding, but none of them present in that case, I would say, or excuse me, in those cases that I've looked at, the role of the non-testifying analyst who did the lab work was not as great as the role of Chow Nguyen in this case. Again, it went simply beyond testing and generating DNA profiles. Claire Myers testified that she, Chow Nguyen, actually performed the laboratory analysis, as well as the extraction, quantification, amplification, and obtaining the profiles. Claire Myers' role was taking the data that was generated by her making interpretations on it. That's Chow Nguyen making interpretations on it. And then Myers' role was making comparisons, performing statistics, and writing a report. So, yes, she did testify to her own opinions, but it's interesting, I'll wrap up with this, that in Paredes and its recent progeny, as I understand the state's argument in this case, they say that the raw DNA profiles stand for nothing on their own and they would be legally meaningless without the expert testimony of that testifying analyst. We think in this case it's kind of reversed, that Claire Myers' testimony would have been legally meaningless and had no probative force had it not been for the work done and the profiles and analysis and interpretations made by Chow Nguyen. And the court stressed in Paredes that the DNA profiles in issue in that were not the functional equivalent of live in-court testimony because they did not come from a witness capable of being cross-examined. Well, in this case, Chow Nguyen was a witness capable of being cross-examined, and we believe that the Sixth Amendment afforded appellant a right to cross-examine her unless there was a showing of unavailability and he had a prior opportunity to cross-examine her before trial, which, of course, he didn't have. So if there are no questions, then...
No question, Mr. Arrington.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I read the record and the testimony of Ms. Moyes, she said that she did her own work from the raw data.
She formed her own opinions, and she said she was testifying to her own opinions. But as far as the actual work that was done to generate the DNA profiles and interpretations that were made on which Claire Myers' opinion and testimony were based, That was all done by Chow Nguyen.
She did not go back to the raw data and form her own opinions from an analysis of the raw data without regard to the work of Chow Nguyen.
I see my time is up. May I respond?
Sorry.
I think it went beyond that. I think she did form her own opinions from the raw data, but I think the record indicates that it was not just the raw data on which her opinion was based. It was Chow Nguyen's interpretation and lab analysis.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Mr. Arrington, Mr. Condor, thank you very much for your arguments here today. We appreciate them. Your case is submitted, and court will be adjourned.